From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Taliban attacks rock Afghan capital. OPEC maintains output. Ukraine's new parliament holds first session and keeps prime minister. A Broadway flop gets a second chance. Those stories and more coming up. I'm Ray Kugel. Taliban insurgents raided a highly secured diplomatic area in Kabul Thursday night, just hours after a suicide attack blew up a British embassy vehicle and killed five people. Ayaz Gul reports the Islamist group claimed responsibility for both attacks.
Afghan officials reported that heavily armed men assaulted a compound of an international organization in the Wazir Akbar Khan diplomatic district. One of the attackers had explosives strapped to his body and blew himself up at the entrance of the building, which houses the staff of the aid agency International Relief and Development. The Deputy Interior Minister, Mohammad Ayub Salangi, says a Nepalese guard was wounded in the exchange of fire. He says Afghan security forces killed two of the attackers. Salangi goes on to say that he has seen the guest house and everything is under control and the fighting is over. The Taliban claimed responsibility for the assault. The violence came hours after a suicide bomber attacked a vehicle belonging to the British embassy and detonated the bomb. The director of Wazir Akbar Khan Hospital, Akram Zada, described the casualties. He says the hospital received 21 wounded victims and 5 dead bodies, one foreigner and 4 Afghans. The British embassy said a British security guard and an Afghan member of the embassy staff were among the dead, but another British officer survived the attack. Local officials said the blast wounded at least 33 people, most of them Afghan civilians. The Taliban claimed it was behind the attack and it targeted a convoy of foreign invading forces. The past few months have seen an unusual rise in Taliban attacks across Afghanistan. The violence comes as U.S.-led international forces plan to officially end their combat mission and withdraw from the country at the end of next month. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
The global oil cartel OPEC decided to maintain current levels of production despite a worldwide oil glut that's driven market prices down more than 30% since June. OPEC spokesman Hassan Hamid made the announcement after oil ministers of the 12-nation cartel met in Vienna on Thursday.
In the interest of restoring market equilibrium, the conference decided to maintain the production level of 30 million barrels a day as was agreed in December 2011.
On news of OPEC's decision, the price of benchmark Brent crude fell an additional $4 to a four-year low of $73 a barrel. Syrian warplanes have carried out more airstrikes on Raqqa, the main city held by the Islamic State group. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says a number of civilians were killed and others wounded in one of the strikes on a house belonging to a judge. The monitoring group says other attacks targeted schools, a hospital, an Islamic State checkpoint, and a building taken over by Islamic State militants. Iran Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei says he supports the move to extend the Iranian nuclear talks. In a speech broadcast on state television Thursday, Ayatollah Khamenei said he does not oppose a 7-month extension for the same reason he has not opposed the talks thus far. He said the United States has the most to lose if the negotiations fail. On Monday, Iran and a group of world powers agreed to extend the talks through June 30th of next year, after the two sides failed to reach a deal to ensure Iran's nuclear program is peaceful in exchange for easing sanctions that have hurt the country's economy. Ukraine's new parliament held its first session Thursday and voted to keep Arseniy Yatsenyuk as the country's prime minister. President Petro Poroshenko and the parliament's newly formed 5-party coalition favor Mr. Yatsenyuk, remaining in the post for another term. In a speech to Parliament, President Poroshenko said he would be a reliable ally in carrying out the reform-minded pro-European agenda of the ruling five-party coalition. A ship carrying 700 migrants was towed into a harbor in Greece after losing power in the Mediterranean Sea. Henry Ridgewell has details.
It has taken the Greek Navy 4 days to tow the cargo ship Baris from international waters into Iera Petra harbour on the Greek island of Crete. The vessel lost power in storm force winds. The approximately 700 migrants on board were exhausted, terrified, but safe. They are being housed in a basketball stadium while their refugee status is assessed. Many are Syrians fleeing the civil war. A senior health official on the island said many would be released. According to European Union rules, the migrants must stay in the country where they first arrive until their asylum claims are assessed. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Researchers say an experimental Ebola vaccine caused no serious side effects and produced an immune response in all 20 healthy volunteers who received it in an early-stage clinical trial. The New England Journal of Medicine reports that scientists will continue to follow the volunteers for another 48 weeks in the study that began in September. The vaccine is produced by British firm GlaxoSmithKline. The World Health Organization says the ongoing Ebola outbreak in West Africa has killed almost 5,700 people. More than 130 people have been killed in tribal clashes in Sudan's oil-rich region near the border with South Sudan. The Ziyud and Olad Omran clans have been fighting for several days over disputed land in West Kordofan. The International Committee of the Red Cross is appealing for just under $1.7 billion to help millions of people whose lives are being torn apart by armed conflict and violence. Lisa Schlein reports.
The International Committee of the Red Cross says the nature of armed conflict is changing. ICRC President Peter Morris says new kinds of crises are emerging in new combinations, often with a regional dimension.
We are not anymore in a situation where we have a clear-cut international or internal armed conflicts with clear-cut front lines and positions unfolding in front of us. We see international armed conflict, internal armed conflict, criminal violence, intercommunal violence, superpositioning itself in the same contexts.
Morris says the conflict in Syria has long ceased to be a civil war. It has become a regional crisis engulfing Iraq, Lebanon, and Jordan. He says extremism is deepening some of the conflicts being waged, leading to increasingly violent behavior.
200,000 people have been killed since the beginning of the conflict in Syria. 9,200 civilians have been killed since the beginning of this year in Iraq. Syria and Iraq have become the epicenters of regional and global insecurities.
Syria is the largest ICRC operation, followed by South Sudan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Israel and the occupied territories, Mali, the Central African Republic, and Ukraine. ICRC President Morris says conflict and violence not only kills people, it kills development. Given the increasing dangers, the Red Cross says it plans to focus greater attention on the protection needs of people caught in conflict. But it says it will continue to give priority to health, particularly surgical care for the wounded. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan will meet with visiting Pope Francis today, and the location of their get-together is stirring up interest. It will be held at Turkey's controversial new presidential palace, the world's largest and costliest. The Pope has made no secret of his dislike for such extravagance. Dorian Jones has more.
President Erdogan will host Pope Francis in his new 1,000-room palace. Decorated trees imported from Italy and silk wallpapered bathrooms suggest no expense has been spared. Built under Mr. Erdogan's personal direction, the White Palace, as it's popularly known, is not only the world's biggest palace, but the costliest one, with a price tag that has hit $700 million and is still rising. How Pope Francis, who has a reputation for shunning ostentation, will react to the palace is a question on the lips of many, say analysts. The Pope's visit is attracting renewed attention to the palace, which has become a symbol of the Islamist-rooted AK Party's dramatic transformation during the decade it has ruled Turkey. In the early years, the AK Party campaigned as a party of the dispossessed, fighting against corruption and waste. Today, explains Ishtar Gözaydın, an expert on religion and the state at Istanbul's Dorsch University, President Erdogan's platform is one of developing and building a new Turkey.
Obviously, there's a tremendous change. It has started from a very modest background, but now the point that they have come is another vision. That's how we're told, actually, the conceptualization of new Turkey.
But protesters have clashed with police over another development project in one of AK Party's key strongholds in Istanbul. The decision to destroy one of the city's last remaining green spaces to make way for a shopping complex and luxury housing provoked anger, even though the plans also included building a mosque. This old woman accuses the party of abandoning its principles.
Şimdi 90 yaşına yakın bir büyüğünüzüm ve buraya hayranlıkla bağlıyım.
I'm so attached to this land. It's a place for everyone, she said. The AK Party was for the people, honest, pious and humble, but not anymore. Look where the president lives. But Turkish TV channels are inundated with commercials for luxury homes, consumer goods and the like. And AK Party supporters have been among the main beneficiaries of a decade of unprecedented economic growth. The Pope's visit is adding fuel to the angry debate over the White Palace. That debate is likely to continue for some time, especially given the recent announcement that the palace is not big enough and another 250 rooms will be added to it in the near future. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Mexico's President Enrique Peña Nieto unveiled a plan for sweeping police reforms amid allegations that authorities have a role in a country's gang-related atrocities. The president's announcement Thursday came hours after 11 beheaded bodies were found in the violence-racked state of Guerrero. Mexican authorities say a note was left at the scene tying the massacre to a criminal group. The victims are reported to be men in their 20s. According to the state governor's office, their identities remain unknown. Much of the debate about immigration in the United States revolves around undocumented Latin Americans who face deportation. One group often overlooked is the estimated 1.3 million illegal immigrants from Asia. President Obama's recent executive order can provide a temporary reprieve from deportation to about 400,000 of those Asian immigrants. But for many, their future is uncertain, as we hear from Elizabeth Lee.
High school student Peter Liu is worried about his future. He left China because there was illness in his family and they were struggling financially. He decided to overstay his tourist visa.
It was a very difficult decision because at the time I thought if I make this decision, I probably will not be able to see my grandparents and my family for many years.
Now he lives in Los Angeles as an undocumented immigrant. Unable to work, he worries about paying for college. President Obama's executive order does not help him because he arrived after the cutoff date for deferred action for childhood arrivals. He says even those who do qualify for temporary relief from deportation are hesitant to apply.
Especially in the Asian community, a lot of people will be very worried if they come out of the shadows and apply for deferred action, whether it will impact their family in some way.
President Obama's executive order suspends the threat of deportation for illegal immigrants who have lived in the U.S. for at least 5 years and have children who are legally in the U.S.
Deportations of criminals.
However, those considered a security threat or who have a criminal record will continue to face deportation. Cambodian refugee David Ross falls into that category. When he was 16, he killed a man and spent almost 19 years in prison. Because of that, he lost his permanent residency status and now awaits deportation.
I came here into this country with no English, no education, no money, and we struggled a lot. And as a result of our struggle, I mean, I made a lot of mistakes in my life.
According to the group, Asian Americans Advancing Justice Asian Law Caucus, Southeast Asians and Pacific Islanders are deported for criminal convictions at five times the rate of other immigrants. Immigration law attorney Xu Ming-Chir says the reasons are complicated.
The failure of refugee resettlement policies and the fact that so many Southeast Asians live in communities where there's already an existing crime rate that's pretty high. And there's just a lack of support, a lack of social networks and institutions that might help give people options besides engaging in crime.
Chir says many of these Southeast Asians have turned their lives around after serving time in prison, including David Ross. He now has a job, supports a family with two children, and volunteers. He hopes the law would change so a judge can decide who, with a criminal record, gets deported.
Bringing judiciary discretion back would be something that is a first step, because the judge can make a decision on the merit of the person, not who the person was, but who the person is today.
Both David Ross and Peter Leo say they are speaking out despite the risk of deportation in hopes that lawmakers will hear their story and reform the immigration system in their favor. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
A heavy police presence, snowy weather, and Thursday's Thanksgiving holiday may have helped to shrink the crowds of protesters in the Midwestern U.S. town of Ferguson, Missouri. Many are still angry over last Monday's announcement that a white police officer will not be prosecuted over the shooting death of an unarmed black teenager. Ferguson saw only scattered protests late Wednesday after two previous nights of unrest and rioting that left dozens of buildings damaged or burned. A new material has been invented that can draw heat out of buildings and send it, along with the sun's radiating warmth, into the coldness of outer space. The revolutionary coating can be of great benefit, though, for those of us still here on Earth. It can cool buildings even on hot days, VOA's Jessica Berman explains.
The unique cooling material is an ultra-thin multi-layered sheet that could be installed on a roof like solar panels. But instead of turning sunlight into energy, it turns heat into invisible light and beams it away as infrared radiation. Stanford University electrical engineer Professor Shan-Hui Fan explains that the panels, which include a layer of material similar to what's found in sand, act like a kind of high-tech mirror, both siphoning heat out of the buildings and reflecting the sun's rays, sending both 100 kilometers up into the coldness of outer space.
It's a structure that cools itself without electricity input, even under the sun. So what it does is basically radiate heat to outer space and also reflect the sunlight so it doesn't get heated up by the sun. And the net result is you get something that if you put on a roof, will have a temperature below ambient air temperature by a significant amount.
The panels, which are cool to the touch even in the sun, can reduce the indoor temperature to nearly 5 degrees Celsius below the temperature outside. The heat is sent directly into space at a frequency that allows it to pass through the atmosphere without warming the air, almost, Fun says, like having a window into space. He says one possible use for the panels would be in buildings in developing countries that have no access to electricity or air conditioning.
In areas where one is off-grid, there's significant potential benefit. For example, for storing medicine or even food, in many of these situations, being able to reduce the temperature is important. And this will provide a way to do it.
The Stanford researchers, who describe the technology on a small scale in the journal Nature, say the main challenge is engineering actual cooling systems using the high-tech panels. One possibility is formulating a cooling spray that could be applied to existing solid structures. They believe the technology could be scaled up in the next 3 to 5 years. Researchers note that as much as 15% of the energy used in the United States is spent powering air conditioning systems, money that could be saved in the long run after the initial cost of outfitting buildings with the cooling material. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein were the writing team that helped usher in what is considered the golden age of American musical theater. In the 1940s and 50s, they had a string of Broadway hits: Oklahoma, Carousel, South Pacific, The King and I, The Sound of Music. And then there was Allegro. Don't be surprised if that name is not familiar. Allegro was a flop. But as Jeff London reports from New York, Allegro is back on stage.
In 1947, composer Richard Rodgers and librettist Oscar Hammerstein were at the top of their game, Rodgers told a radio interviewer a decade later.
If you're reasonably rational and have any objectivity, you know that after you've had Oklahoma State Fair and Carousel in a Row, this is a very good time to be cautious. This is when it's liable to sneak up from behind and hit you on the back of the head.
Allegro knocked them flat.
Brisk, lively, merry, and bright Allegro. Same tempo morning and night Allegro.
The collaborators had helped usher in the modern musical with Oklahoma and Carousel, in which song, story, and dance were tightly integrated. In Allegro, they wanted to take those innovations a step further, as Oscar Hammerstein said in 1958.
Certainly in its conception, it was epic, conceived of a man from the date of his birth, following him through his youth and into his middle age. This boy had started as a country doctor and had then, through an overambitious wife, got mixed up in a kind of society doctor practice, and was devoting more time to the social life that goes around medicine than medicine itself.
The deep-thinking gentlemen and ladies who keep a metropolis alive drink cocktails and mocktails every afternoon at 5.
The show was directed and choreographed by the acclaimed Agnes DeMille. It arrived on Broadway with a cast of close to 100 and the biggest advance ticket sales in Broadway history at the time. But reviews were mixed, and Allegro only lasted a season. Witnessing all this was a 17-year-old production intern, Stephen Sondheim.
What was interesting was I watched a lot of very knowledgeable people put on a flop. And by flop, it was a show that didn't work the way it was intended. And it didn't work partly because it was a highly experimental show.
And highly influential for the fledgling songwriter, who went on to become the voice of his generation with shows like Sweeney Todd and Sunday in the Park with George. Sondheim cites the show's unusual song structures and large Greek chorus.
Maybe going forward is easier than standing still. Come on!
In reviving the musical off-Broadway with a pared-down cast of 12 actors, all of whom play musical instruments, British director John Doyle focuses on the themes of Allegro.
It's a piece that's making a message about, I think, about the implications of certain aspects of the American dream. And if you want to follow your dreams, does that have to mean making a lot of money? In a world that values ambition, what does ambition really mean?
Money isn't everything. What can money buy? An automobile so you won't get wet. Champagne so you won't get dry.
Claiborne Elder plays the protagonist, torn between the trappings of success and making a contribution to society. Elder says the bare-bones staging of the current revival serves Hammerstein's words and Rodgers' music quite well.
We are doing it in a very modern way, maybe, but we are doing the text that they wrote in the way they wrote it, and it's like that. The fact that it resonates today with an audience as being edgy and a little bizarre is pretty incredible.
And Rodgers and Hammerstein? While they were disappointed with the reaction to Allegro and vowed to rewrite it, they moved on. Their next two shows were South Pacific, which captured a Pulitzer Prize, and The King and I, which featured a half dozen hit songs. For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
And that's it for this edition of International Edition. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
This is Today in History. On November 28, 1520, Portuguese explorer Ferdinand Magellan, in the midst of the first known circumnavigation of the Earth, sailed around the tip of South America. He entered the waters of what he called the Pacific Ocean. On this date in 1820, German social scientist Friedrich Engels was born. Engels collaborated with Karl Marx in developing communist theory, co-authoring the Communist Manifesto in 1848. In 1859, noted American author Washington Irving died. Irving wrote many short stories, including The Legend of Sleepy Hollow and Rip Van Winkle. On this day in 1919, American-born political activist Nancy Astor became the first woman to be seated in the British House of Commons, that coming after her husband vacated the seat for the House of Lords. In 1942, 492 people died in a fire that destroyed the Coconut Grove nightclub in the American city of Boston. In 1943, U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt joined British Prime Minister Winston Churchill and Soviet leader Joseph Stalin in Iran at the start of their first wartime conference. In 1954, Nobel Prize-winning Italian physicist Enrico Fermi died. He was noted for being the first to create and control a nuclear chain reaction. On this day in 1979, Air New Zealand Flight 901, a DC-10 jetliner on a sightseeing trip over Antarctica, crashed into the Mount Erebus volcano, killing all 257 people on board. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Vice President Joe Biden recently traveled to Turkey, where he met with Turkish President Recep Erdogan and Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoglu. A top agenda item was Turkey's role in the international coalition to degrade and defeat the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL. Turkey has demonstrated significant leadership in reaching out to and coordinating with the new Iraqi government, including a recent visit by Turkish Prime Minister Davutoglu to Erbil and Baghdad. Together, the United States and Turkey are working to curb the flow of foreign fighters to and from the battlefields of Iraq and Syria and to stem their funding streams. With regard to Syria, the United States and Turkey discussed efforts to deny ISIL a safe haven, strengthen the Syrian opposition, and pursue a negotiated solution to the conflict that ultimately leads to a transitional government without the Bashar al-Assad regime. Vice President Biden and President Erdogan also discussed efforts to train and equip moderate Syrian opposition forces. Turkey, as a consequence of the ongoing conflict in Syria, is carrying a heavy humanitarian burden. Nearly 1.6 million refugees from Syria have poured over Turkey's border. Turkey is providing all manner of humanitarian relief, including housing, health care, food, and clothing. The United States has donated more than $3 billion in humanitarian assistance to ease the suffering of those inside Syria and to support refugees in neighboring countries, including $222 million for international humanitarian organizations working with the government of Turkey. On Cyprus, the United States remains committed to supporting the United Nations-led effort to reunify the island as a bi-zonal, bi-communal federation. Vice President Biden said the potential exists to reach a solution that benefits everyone on the island and in the region. Right now, that requires a focus on de-escalating tensions and returning to the negotiating table in Cyprus. The United States and Turkey have been allies for 60 years. Today, said Vice President Biden, we're working closely together once again to meet the very pressing challenges of this moment and to further strengthen the strategic partnership between Turkey and America.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.